Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Steve Bauscher, and I would like to welcome you to another edition of The Intersection, a podcast focused on the intersection of national security and technology. And we are very excited today to have as our guest Jacob Heiberg, a senior advisor to the Stanford University Center on Geopolitics and Technology, and adjunct professor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Jacob recently published a book, Wires of War, that I was very fascinated by and prompted my interest in having him on the podcast here today. And I encourage anyone interested in this subject to go ahead and pick it up or download it and take a look at it, because it dives into the complexities of technology policy, China, and the U.S. On national security policy. And it's incredibly focused on what we love to talk about here at The Intersection. Just a little bit more background on Jacob. He's also co-chair of the Brookings Institution China Strategy Working Group, where he helps support and lead research efforts focused on China's intentions, foreign policy, and what the right long-term U.S. strategy should be to meet those challenges. He's also co-chair of the Brookings Institution U.S.-France Working Group on China, and he's a member of the National Security Action Network and a member of the Manufacturing Leadership Council at the National Association of Manufacturers. So, Jacob, thank you, and welcome to The Intersection.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve, and thanks for the very generous introduction.
It's terrific. Like I said, I really got fired up about your book here, so excited to have you on the show here today. Jacob, maybe before we get into that, just tell us a little bit more about your background and what led you to where you are today. I think we have a lot of listeners who are people planning their career in sort of this area, and they love to hear, I think, from our guests what the path is that they took from, say, college or grad school to where they got to today.
I started my work in technology thinking about geopolitics as systems when I worked at a company called GeoQuant as a member of the founding team. GeoQuant is a company that basically used software to measure and predict geopolitical risk. But the way that it did that was basically by taking existing models of political science and then using software to analyze at scale enormous amounts of data. But the basic premise was to think holistically about geopolitical dynamics as systems, where one event in one marker of geopolitical risk could lead to a ripple effect of and a causal chain of events that impacts how systems interact with one another. And after I did that, I joined Google's policy team, where I helped the company's executives wrestle with a new emerging issue that became known as foreign interference, which was basically the basic phenomenon of foreign, primarily autocratic governments that are using software and the free flow of information to distort the information that people in democracies see and interact with every day. That quickly morphed into basically thinking about bigger picture trends of how autocratic governments are, generally speaking, treating and approaching the tech industry writ large. As you know, the company and as the tech industry as a whole quickly became caught in the crosshairs of geopolitics, a lot of people in the tech industry were both coming to grips with what this meant for the American technology industry, what this meant for the two-year strategy for how tech companies should approach this new trend, and how people should understand this. And ultimately, as I started traveling around the campaign trail with Pete Buttigieg and thinking about, the best way for me to make a contribution to a space that I felt very passionate about, I decided to leave Google, which is a company that I very much enjoyed working at, to write a book to help encourage a broader policy debate on this issue that I became very passionate about.
That's fantastic. So when you talk about foreign interference, just to be clear to our listeners, you're not talking just about hacking. You're not talking just about misinformation. You're talking about a whole multitude, if you will, of ways that China, Russia, and other autocratic governments use technology to project power and increase influence around the world. Is that fair?
Yeah, so foreign interference, just like the term fake news, are terms that are often used by a lot of people to refer sometimes to slightly different things. Mm-hmm. The way that I use foreign interference, so the foreign interference is most commonly used in the press to refer to information operations. So specifically to things that are akin to what Russia did in 2016, which is basically the mass publication of news content that, you know, fake news content that masquerades as authentic journalism, independent journalism, but that's actually being written by, you know, covert employees of the Russian government, and to try to basically push narratives that discredit democracy, that in some way, shape, or form advance Russia's interests. There is, you know, the broader way in which I refer to foreign interference is the phenomenon. It's a slightly more general phenomenon. It's not just information operations, but it's the general phenomenon of foreign autocratic governments using technology to interfere in the political affairs of a democracy.
Great.
Which can include information operations. It could include, you know, hacking. It could include a variety of other tactics.
You leave Google, you join Stanford, you join Brookings, and what led you to decide that, hey, I want to write a book?
So I was working on, I was going through the intellectual exercise of thinking through what should, if there were a two-year strategy that a tech company should you know, think about, when we think about what are the issues, the new tech policy issues that we're brewing on the horizon with synthetic media, with AI, with the whole swath of new technologies that are in the pipeline, and how tech companies should think about how these technologies could be used by bad actors to undermine the integrity of commercial products and to undermine and to ultimately harm, you know, democratic societies. It became very clear that a lot of these issues, that first of all, there was this broader trend at work that where governments are increasingly approaching and treating tech companies as targets and tools of geopolitical competition and power, and that ultimately these issues are transcendent to a single company, but that are really about the American tech industry as a whole. And so that's why I decided to try to have to aim for a slightly bigger impact of encouraging a policy debate on issues that I thought were being under-discussed. And so the best way that I could think of at the time to do that, to encourage that policy debate, was by writing a book to help talk about issues that I didn't feel were being captured by the mainstream of the, you know, journalistic conversations.
Great. And so if you had a chance to sit down with the CEO of Apple or Google or Facebook or you know, pick your favorite tech company, what would you tell them? What's the thesis of your book? What should they be thinking about? What should they be worried about? And what should they be doing?
I think if I could tell them one thing, it's that that the U.S. and China are, you know, in what I call a gray war. Some people call it a cold war, but they are in a state of an adversarial relationship that goes far beyond just simple, friendly competition. It's a very, you know, it's as George Orwell said, it's a peace that is no peace. And that ultimately what this means for tech companies is that they're not going to be able to play both sides indefinitely. You know, the days in which, as Kurt Campbell said, the days of engagement are over. And so if you're Apple, that means, I know that it's hard to think about moving your supply chains because it's very expensive and it's a lot of work, but that's work that you know, Apple should really be thinking about seriously, because if ever their supply chains were compromised, the entire integrity of the company could be on the line. And if you're Google, that means trying to think about an international, you know, what people in the tech industry called I18N, which is basically what is your international strategy? If you think about a world where you're going to be competing with state-backed, you know, state-sanctioned tech giants, and in a world that's basically going to be very adversarial to American interests and American companies.
So do you think, and I hate to use the term big tech because I think it's a very monolithical term applied to a very heterogeneous set of technology companies that have very differing and conflicting interests. But Do you think that the leading tech companies here in the United States do understand that thesis, or are a lot of them still trying to have it both ways, to your point, still think that I can go do business in China and in business in the US, and that's not going to cause me any issues long term?
I think they're becoming more appreciative of and aware of the dynamics at work. But I think for a whole host of well-intentioned reasons, I think they're still very slow to draw the logical conclusions of, you know, what should be obvious to anyone reading the news. And so unfortunately, I think that creates a lot of national security problems for the US, because ultimately, you know, unlike in China, we don't have civil military fusion. As I jokingly say in the book, we have civil military confusion in the US because we have a very decentralized system where a lot of the new technologies aren't really coming out of, you know, they're not directly coming out of the Pentagon, although obviously the government does a lot of great work in seeding new technologies, as you guys do at InQtel. But a lot of breakthrough technologies come out of the private sector. And so when you have a situation where some of our largest tech companies that have an incredible deep bench of technical talent are dragging their feet with being more cooperative with America's broader national security interests, that's ultimately a loss for American national security. But long term, it's also a loss for American companies. I mean, American companies fundamentally rely on basic principles that the U.S. stands for internationally, like the rule of law and free flow of information and open and free internet. Tech companies would have never been able to prosper over the last 20 years had it not been for those basic principles that the U.S. has championed around the world.
No, we agree. You know, and one of the theses that we have stated on this show and other places is that, you know, if you look in the last nation state competition that the U.S. was engaged in, the Cold War with Russia, technology was a key strategic lever in that competition. But it was basically government purpose-built technology that was the strategic lever, right? It was military platforms, space platforms, things that large contractors and large technology companies built special purpose for the U.S. government, sold to the U.S. government, and the U.S. government procured it that way. And that's how they competed and ultimately won that nation-state competition. If you look at the new one that's happening today, the technology will be even more of a key strategic lever in this competition, but it's not government purpose-built technology that's going to carry the day. It's commercial technology and the leverage and the use of that. And as you aptly point out, China gets that in their use of technology to enable critical infrastructure around the world, their use of technology to influence operations around the world, is mainly based on technologies developed for commercial purposes, not government purposes. And the U.S. produces great commercial technology, but doesn't do a very good job of integrating that capability, if you will, into some sort of holistic government or country strategy. And so, I think that thesis, which we've been espousing here for a little while now, I think fits very well with what you've been writing and talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the mission that InQtel has is actually, you know, there's a whole chapter in my book that talks about the importance of bridging the rift between the hill and the valley. Mm-hmm. And in so many ways, the work that you guys have been doing is actually dedicated to doing just that. And it's so important to be able to find ways in which our private sector can collaborate with the public sector, because at the end of the day, the latest launch of the hypersonic missile this summer should be such a wake-up call for everyone that works in national security and in our tech industry about just how incredibly important it is for us to accelerate, you know, the development of key capabilities, because it was pretty terrifying to read. It was pretty terrifying to read reports that some of the capabilities that China demonstrated with the launch of the hypersonic missile are unprecedented and are capabilities that no one, including the U.S., has today.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The launch a few weeks ago now, at this point in the airing of the the podcast certainly captured a lot of attention and interest. Flipping over to the other side now, we've talked about what you would say if you had a chance to talk to the leading executives of our technology industry. Similarly, if you got a chance to talk to senators or congresswomen chairing, you know, various important committees in the Congress, or if you got to talk to folks in the executive branch, NSC folks, president, vice president, what would you say, you know, is what the country should wake up to, what the government should wake up to, and what the government should be doing about all this?
Well, I think one of the most important things that the government should do, especially the legislature that Congress could do, is pass an outbound safest framework. Because if you look at so many, every time the government has a big strategic objective with China, it immediately runs into friction with pockets of the business community that have, you know, intertwined conflicting interests, business interests in China that they've accrued over the course of the last 20 years. And at the end of the day, it's we need to have our business community on our side. And it's going to be very detrimental to us if we continue having, you know, Hollywood, Wall Street, and other types of industries that are very influential in the U.S. that are so deeply economically and financially embedded in China. And ultimately, it's just simply morally and it's morally wrong and a cognitive dissonance, I think, to a lot of Americans to think that China is able to use the power of its market to influence speech censorship and speech, you know, generally in the U.S. through Hollywood. For example, it's been able to basically influence Hollywood studios to include scenes in movies that show futuristic scenes that show, you know, the Shanghai skyline as the future, or that show the greed and excesses of democratic society. I mean, that is just fundamentally antithetical to our, you know, notions of the separation of church and state between government and free speech. And likewise, Wall Street should not be creating and should not be continuing to create new funds that take American money and some of it American pension fund money that's retirement accounts of American citizens and investing those dollars in China that could potentially help PLA affiliated entities in China. So it's just, it's the oddest of situations where you have American investors that are basically helping fund, you know, companies that some of them have ties with the PLA. And an outbound CFIUS framework would basically help solve almost all of that, giving the government the ability to review American investments outbound into China on grounds of national security, I think is vitally important.
Interesting. Do you know of any plans or contemplations of such ideas going on right now?
Well, from what I hear, there's interest in this space. It has yet to make its way into a concrete bill, but from what I understand, it's actually likely in the next, you know, 2 to 4 years to eventually come up in legislation.
What is your view of the future? How does this competition play out? And what do you think the world looks like over the next 5 to 10 years here as this competition continues?
Well, ultimately, what China is doing is it's using 21st century technologies to basically recreate 20th century style spheres of influence. And so as, you know, Secretary Clinton back in the early 2010s, very eloquently in an internet freedom speech, this was in the early days of the Arab Spring, talked about how a digital iron wall was descending on the internet. And I think those observations were fairly prescient. And so what we're seeing today is that it's not just about, you know, at the time she was basically referring to speech censorship online. So, for example, the Iranian and Egyptian government that were basically shutting down the internet to try to prevent protesters from assembling and speaking out against the government. But what we're seeing today is actually goes beyond just censorship. It goes to surveillance and control of the back-end infrastructure, ways in which governments, and specifically ways in which China is leveraging its control over Chinese back-end infrastructure through Huawei and ZTE to basically use that infrastructure as a vehicle to expand and internationalize the values of its political system.
Absolutely. We make the analogy sometimes that, you know, Huawei is the aircraft carrier and SenseTime is the payload, you know, and they're using their civilian technologies as a way to export and extend their power and their influence around the world.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah. In a recent interview, you said you think there are some fatal flaw underlying it. Attempts by U.S. companies to make it in China's market. What do you think that is?
Well, I think the fatal flaw is assuming that, I think for a long time, American companies were a little bit, were succumbing to the tragedy of the commons, where they thought, a lot of companies have tried penetrating the Chinese market, but you know, we're going to be different. We're going to hire and find a CCP insider that we're gonna work with locally, and it's gonna be a Chinese run entity, and we're just gonna put money in it. And you know, it's gonna work because it's gonna be, the Chinese are basically gonna have enough control over it that they'll feel comfortable with the venture. And ultimately, time after time again, they take the money rarely makes its way out of China. And it's at the end of the day, when the Chinese government writes the rules, Chinese companies win. American companies rarely ever win long-term, in China. And so, and there are very, very few exceptions to this rule. And so I think that that's, you know, from an economic standpoint, that's obviously a fatal flaw, but ultimately, from a more long-term, you know, political standpoint, I think philosophically, one of the flaws that that a lot of companies still fail to appreciate is the fact that the values that undergird the legal systems in China and the US are fundamentally at odds. And so it's very hard for companies to comply with two systems that fundamentally conflict with each other. And you know, one example that I give in the book is basically, you know, talks about how in the US we have a system that's predicated on free speech, on privacy protections, on protection of IP. And in China, you have a system that is predicated on total compliance with the CCP, on censorship, on surveillance. And so when you find yourself in a situation, I mean, if you are a cloud service company and you have a user that is a Uyghur dissident located in the United States, and the Chinese government comes to you and asks you, hey, we'd like you to hand over the data, the user data of this Uyghur dissident who's a Chinese national, are you going to observe American law on the basis that that person is in the US, or are you going to observe Chinese laws on the basis that it's a Chinese national? It's a very, very hard question. And that's just one example that's reflective of a much bigger issue, which is that these values are at odds and these legal systems are at odds. And when you operate on a global scale, it's very hard to comply with two systems that fundamentally contradict each other.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And I don't know if you've followed at all the evolution of the U.S. venture capital investment activity in China, but the path that it played out, I think, you know, resonates with what you just described. I know a lot of our listeners are in the venture, but you know, I'm old. I can remember in 2000 when, for the first time, U.S. venture capitalists started to fly over to China. You know, the dot-com bubble had burst. Venture capitalists like to invest in growth. They were looking for growth, and you know, it was there to be found in China. And so, a lot of firms went over there, opened up offices by sending, you know, two or so American partners over there. They would typically hire one local national into the office, and they operated as an office of the larger U.S. firm for a number of years. Then they started to figure out that, oh, to get the best deals in China, you really need to have a Chinese national team. So, you know, the offices started to change from being more U.S. citizens than Chinese citizens to being more Chinese citizens than U.S. citizens. And then a little bit later, they started to figure out, oh, well, you know what? These teams of Chinese nationals, they're going to spin out and start their own funds and there'll be a Chinese venture fund. And that's somehow going to allow them to win more deals than the U.S. venture firms are going to win over there. You know, and so they gradually pushed out the influence, control, and power of both the U.S. firms and the U.S. citizens over sort of a 20-year period to where now the best performing funds over there, for the most part, are the Chinese native funds. You know, there's a few U.S. firms still active and successful over there, but a lot of firms have pulled back their efforts over there because they figured out it's not really a level playing field and they can't get their money out, and there's a lot of other challenges there. So it plays very well into what you just said.
Yeah, I mean, I was having a conversation with someone not too long ago who manages the large fund of a foundation. And he, you know, obviously they've invested over the years, you know, back in the days when it was the predominant, you know, zeitgeist was that it was perfectly fine to do business in China and that China would eventually liberalize, has invested quite a lot of money. And that money, you know, the returns on that money have been pretty impressive, but obviously the money's still in China. He hasn't, you know, there has been no exit event for those investments. And you know, they haven't repatriated that cash. And so right now it's really just paper money. And I was telling him, look, the relationship between the US and China over the next 5 years is probably not going to go anywhere but south. And if things get really rocky, you're not going to get your money back because the Chinese government is either going to freeze assets of large American investors, or they're probably going to nationalize it, but they're not going to allow American investors to just repatriate billions and billions of dollars of cash from the Chinese market into the US. You know, if the US and China actually, you know, tip over to some sort of showdown in Taiwan.
Yeah, I agree with that 150%. So we've talked a lot about China on this podcast, but just to wrap up here, they're not the only autocratic regime out there that we need to worry about or that we need to observe what they're doing. Can you talk a little bit about some of the other countries we should pay attention to and what they might be doing?
Sure. So Russia's obviously, you know, an actor that has been very supportive of China's agenda in a whole host of ways, particularly with respect to finding ways, creative ways of eroding American influence in, you know, Eastern Europe and in the Pacific. Russia and China have obviously been doing joint naval operations and military exercises in the Pacific. And obviously, it was recently reported that they've encircled, they did a drill that entailed encircling Japan, which is probably pretty concerning for Japan, as well as just the stability of the regional stability generally. Russia was obviously one of the players that really demonstrated, you know, that did this proof of concept of how effective information operations could be back in, you know, 2014, 2015, 2016. And since then, the Iranians have also jumped on the bandwagon, creating, you know, on a slightly smaller scale, but, you know, still present nonetheless, creating, you know, fake news outlets that masquerade as real independent journalism to basically try to push anti-American and anti-Israeli content on the open web in democracies, and attacking any kind of political figure in democracies that's critical of the Russian and the Iranian government.
Yeah, no, it's a scary world out there, and I think it's only going to get scarier. Well, Jacob, thank you so much for your time here. We greatly appreciate it. If there's any last points that you'd like to make that I haven't had a chance to hit on yet, that you think our listeners should know about this topic, I'd love to hear them. So I'll give you one last chance.
Sure. So if I may, I'd love to just close on actually two short points. The first is, I think it's so important. Obviously, I wrote this book because these are issues that I'm incredibly passionate about. But I think it's always important to caveat that a lot of the issues that we discuss in these conversations are about a political matter between governments and are obviously in no way meant to diminish the historical importance and how, you know, the cultural wealth of the Chinese people and the Russian people. Russia and China are historically important countries that are incredibly culturally rich, and you know, we've been so lucky in the U.S. to benefit from the contributions of the Russian and Chinese diaspora, and in a way, you know, that's part of what we stand for in this geopolitical contest is very much the model that we represent, which is an open model and the idea that you can come from anywhere and live under a rule of law where everyone is treated equally. And so I think it's important to note that, because that's not the model that they stand for. And the last point that that I would like to end with is, I know that in the foreign policy community, people often give way to a soft sense of defeatism and the idea that because democracies are slow, because you know they're slow to act, and China has 1.4 billion people, I know that a lot of people nowadays feel are a bit down on America's prospects, but I think it's important to remember that one of the things that gives me a great deal of optimism is the fact that ideas matter. And China can have all the planes and all the ships and all of the masses of armed men that it can, you know, that it can create, but you're looking at a leader, Xi Jinping, that is terrified of a mouse of free thought and words. And fundamentally, that is a fatal flaw in these autocratic systems that should give us a lot of reasons to feel good about, you know, the fact that we stand on the side of people's basic human instincts and human nature, that that people, you know, want to yearn to be free. And so I think it's really important to remember that.
Yeah, no, I think that last point is really important. I spend all my time, as you know, immersed in the ecosystem of the U.S. Startup system. And the entrepreneurs and the venture capitalists that I meet with, there's still a level of creativity, innovation, and invention, you know, in the ecosystem here, driven by the underlying principles and values of this country that give me cause as well to believe that we can and will win this competition. So, Jacob, thank you very much for the time. Thank you for joining me at The Intersection. And I hope our listeners enjoyed this conversation. I certainly did. And look forward to talking to you soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.